And this is a show that that made shift your paradigm on both what we know about the ancient world and what we might think is waiting yet to be discovered at the bottom of the ocean. You know, it's often been said that the answer to all of the world's mysteries are in some shoebox in somebody's closet. Well, a lot of ways, the oceans are really like a big giant closet, and those shipwrecks are like little shoeboxes waiting for us to find devices like this. The Antikythera Mechanism, Decoding the Heavens, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, again, let me make sure I got this right, because if I had your name, it would probably be Marchant, but you're saying it's Marchant.
Marchant, yes, like merchant, okay. With an A.
Oh, good. I'm just checking. And I so love what you've written here, Decoding the Heavens, fascinating book. These are like my favorite kinds of books.
Great.
Because it's not just about the past, and I love history books, but also because it takes us into very unusual, sort of almost an alternative thread to history, because this information was buried literally for so long.
Yeah, it really changes the way we think about the ancient world. It shows how much we take things for granted, I think, and there's so much more out there that we don't realize.
And so much more out there that we haven't discovered yet. And who knows how many other mechanisms like this might be sitting in the bottom of a shipwreck somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, this is so different from anything else that we know of from the ancient world that it really does make you think, well, what else could be there?
Well, let's lay out some facts so people can follow this, because it's so important to get some of the basics in. Antikythera is the name of the island nearest to where the shipwreck was found.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little island. It's actually nearer to a bigger island called Kythera, hence the name.
Right, right.
And it's just it's south of the southern tip of Greece, so in the middle of the Mediterranean. And the shipwreck was actually discovered by sponge divers in the year 1900. They were fishing for sponges off the coast of North Africa all summer, heading back home east to the island of Symi, which is where they were from. In the autumn, blown off course by a storm, and they sought shelter in a little bay at the island of Antikythera. And when the storm calmed, they dived down and found the wreck.
Now, and by the way, if there's an Antikythera and a Kythera, is there also a post-Kythera? Is there another?
I don't think so.
And there's no post-Kythera. Okay. So this little island, not very well inhabited, and yet, when they went down, I thought this was interesting that the technology these sponge divers were using fairly cutting edge technology for sponge divers in 1900.
For the time, yeah, for thousands of years, divers in the Mediterranean have been earning a living cutting sponges from the seabed, but they've been diving naked with a large stone to weigh them down since Homer's time, and it was only in the 1860s when this sort of cutting-edge new technology was introduced, which was these big, heavy canvas suits with rubber seals and these large copper helmets with little windows in the front. People have probably seen the helmets, like having a porthole to look through. And they were breathing compressed air through a tube, which led to a compressor in the boat above. And this really revolutionized the industry. It vastly increased the amount of time that divers could stay down, the depths that they could go to, so the number of sponges that they could harvest. So huge amounts of money were being made, but at the same time, they didn't realize what breathing compressed air at depth was doing to their bodies. They had no understanding of the bends. So tens of thousands of divers died in the decades following the 1860s of the bends, and many more were paralyzed. So it was a very dangerous pursuit at the time.
And that in itself is an interesting digression. That they were sort of the early focus group for research into deep sea diving. Inadvertently.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the scientists at the time actually worked with the sponge divers in the Mediterranean to try and see what actually was happening to their bodies at the time, because they really were at the forefront of this. I mean, there was no navy in the world that could dive as deep as the sponge divers were doing at this time.
So, on a fairly low tech operation, otherwise, I mean, they had these boats, not necessarily big ones, and they were deep sea diving for sponges, and that's where they came across this shipwreck. And I love the stories you tell it, because when the very first diver came right back up, He wasn't sure what he had seen, but it looked like men and women and children that were in the shipwreck in the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, you're right. It's a great story. So they're in these two tiny little boats. There was Captain Comtos and his men, and little sort of wooden boats, just with a sail and some oars as well for making progress on calm days. And the first diver dropped down. They had one diving suit, which all of the divers would have just taken turns using because they couldn't afford more than that. So he put on the suit and went down, but emerged 5 minutes later, sort of shaking, agitated, when they pulled off his helmet, gabbling about this pile of dead naked women that he'd seen on the seabed. So the captain put on the suit and went down, and he realized that this wasn't a pile of corpses. This was a pile of statues, bronze statues from an ancient wreck. And it turned out actually to be the biggest hoard of ancient treasure that had ever been discovered up to that point. And the divers ended up being hired by the Greek government to salvage that wreck. And again, it was the first wreck ever salvaged by archaeologists. And it really made headlines around the world at the time. This was 1900, with all the treasures that were coming back, bronze and marble statues. There was jewelry, armor, an ornate bronze throne. There was other furniture, all kinds of things coming back from the wreck.
But we suspect that maybe a few of the easy-to-haul pieces may have ended up in the pockets of the people on the ship that didn't end up getting reported to the Greek Antiquities Authority.
Yes. The official Greek version is that the divers were very patriotic. The island where they lived was actually owned by Turkey at the time, but they spoke Greek and would have thought of themselves as Greek. And the official story is that they went straight to the government in Athens and reported the find and were hired to salvage it. But there were other stories sort of floating around the inns and the island where they came from that actually they spent a fair bit of time pulling up what they could for themselves before doing that, which sounds a bit more plausible to me, I have to say. I mean, who knows what actually happened. But so some of the smaller statues, and particularly some of the lead weights from the anchors and that kind of thing, would have been very useful to the divers as well. So they probably pocketed a little bit of it.
But that only makes sense. I mean, that only makes sense because that's what they did for a living, was pull stuff off the... You know, I mean, this is... You couldn't... And who knows what... Once you told the government about it, there may not have been anything else in it for them after that. And I'm sure it's not the first artifact they found lying on the ocean floor that they yanked up along with a sponge.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been any legal requirement for them to report the find. I mean, there wasn't any kind of obligation for them to do that. So I think it is quite plausible that they would have taken some of the smaller pieces, but then when they realized the larger stuff they were going to need help with, they basically went to the government and said, you know, if you give us sort of backup and ships and winches to help us with this, then we will salvage it as long as you pay us the full value of everything that we bring up for you. And the government said, fair enough, and then that was the deal that they worked under.
Yeah, I think the ancient international law of finders keepers was in effect until they came across stuff they couldn't move, and then it was time to contact the government. And so that's when, in hauling up these statues, and the statues play an important part in understanding the history of this mechanism, which we'll get to. But they start to get a better impression of just what a treasure they have. How are they able to start dating the statues? Before we even get to the mechanism, talk about the statues a little bit.
Well, really, it's from the style of the sculpture. So archaeologists can look at different statues, and you'll have different styles from different times and start to make a guess as to exactly when they came from. So the first thing is these were Greek statues. Marble and bronze, and there were actually a range of ages. So some of them are from the 4th and 5th century BC, so this was the sort of the height of classical Greek sculpture, really very beautiful pieces. Some of them were a bit more recent, perhaps 2nd, 3rd century BC. So it looks as though some of the statues would have been antiques at the time that they were put onto the ship. But the other interesting thing is that the ship itself is actually a Roman ship. It wasn't a Greek ship. And another thing that they saw when they looked at the statues was that they still had traces of lead on their base on their feet, which would have once attached them to bases. So it looked as though these statues had perhaps been ripped down in a hurry. So all that together suggests that perhaps these Greek treasures were actually stolen by the Romans from Greek territories in the east and were perhaps being shipped back west to Rome.
Well, and that would be consistent with how the Roman government, the Republic, was funding itself at the time, right? It was kind of a they too had a kind of a finders keepers sort of mentality, and they would take from whatever lands they were conquering the easily portable antiquities that they wanted from that. And they brought them to their own culture, which they thought was lacking or they were self-conscious about. So they were always borrowing other people's beauty. Would that be a fair way to describe
it? So the best guess for the timing of this ship's last voyage is the 1st century BC. And at this time, the Romans really were spreading out across the Mediterranean, particularly through the Greek world, conquering the territories there and basically taking anything that they wanted, so gold and grain and all sorts of things like that, but also various different sort of treasures and statues. And you're right, they really admired Greek art and culture. So anything like that, they basically just swiped anything they liked the look of and shipped it back home.
We're talking about decoding the heavens with Joe Marchant. So they couldn't figure that out at first. It took a little while to kind of determine what kind of ship and what, but it's consistent with this idea that in the 1st century BC that the Romans were out collecting stuff and bringing it back to Rome so that they could put it on display and celebrate how big their empire was, and that's where the statues were coming from, and very likely that's how the Antikythera mechanism was procured and put into the same ship. Now, beyond the fact that it's in the same ship, do the statues give us an idea of where the Antikythera mechanism would have come from? Does the statues tell us where they were, where they likely would have found the box?
It's quite tricky. With the statues, it's hard to say exactly where they came from, and these things could have been shipped. They could have been quite old, as I said, by the time they were put onto the ship, and could have been shipped around before they ended up on this particular ship. So everything's pointing towards the Eastern Mediterranean, but beyond that, it's hard to pinpoint it exactly. It's possible to pinpoint exactly where the ship sails from, not so much from the statues, but from other items that were on board. So this wasn't done so much when the wreck was first found, but in later years, archaeologists have started looking at pots and plates and things like that from the ship, which would have been sort of freshly made at the time that the ship sailed, because they wouldn't last that long. They'd probably break on board ship. And those can help you to pin down exactly the starting point of the ship a bit more precisely.
So at least we can tell what might have been ports of call for this ship, even if we can't tell which one of those ports was the origin of the Antikythera mechanism.
Yeah, so you've got glassware and as I said, pots and plates and that kind of thing, which are coming from the Asia Minor coast, so what is now Turkey. Also a couple of pieces that may have come from Alexandria, and jars sort of holding wine that would have come from Rhodes and Kos. And Rhodes in particular was a very popular trading post, so every ship going from east to west or back again would have stopped off at Rhodes for supplies on the way. We're looking at probably one of the major cities on the Asia Minor coast as a starting point, and then Rhodes as a key sort of stop-off as well.
Yeah, but that's such a wide area that it doesn't really give us much about the background of the Antikythera mechanism.
No, I mean, it's one line of evidence. So with this mechanism, you kind of have to look at lots of sources and try and piece together like a jigsaw all the different bits of information that you're getting.
And that's just what we're going to do here. So they start pulling up these statues, and they pull up this thing which they don't really even know what it is, but it's just amongst the statues. Talk about what the divers thought they had found. What was it when they hauled it up? What did they do with it?
Well, you have to imagine that a lot of these statues and all of the artifacts they're pulling up, a lot of them are in pieces, a lot of them are very corroded, a lot of them have got sort of various kind of just they kind of had a limestone coating on them from, you know, they've been under the sea for 2,000 years. So although some of the statues are immediately recognizable, a lot of what they're bringing up just looks like pieces of junk, like bits of old stone, basically. So they're pulling up basically everything they can from the seabed, and it's all being shipped back to Athens to sort of worldwide acclaim, making newspaper headlines. And it's taken to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, where the staff there have a crazy time basically taking all of this stuff and trying to work out, you know, what's interesting, what isn't, what pieces go with what. Basically, all of these sort of bits are being shoved into crates in an open courtyard because it's all coming in faster than they can deal with it. And they're sifting through, looking for bits that go together, trying to piece together the statues and that kind of thing. So just one of these unassuming-looking lumps of rock, basically, that was just sitting in a crate for months outside and continuing to erode away in that time because of the chemical reactions in the air. Nobody paid any attention to it. And it wasn't until several months later when this particular piece of rock cracked open. It's not clear whether it was... The wooden casing kind of shrank as it dried and pulled this thing open, or whether someone just hit it with a hammer to see what was inside. But when it did break open, that's when they realized that they had something very special.
And it wouldn't be the last time that the Antikythera mechanism spent some time in a crate, too, not being fully appreciated, and we'll get back to that coming up. But the interesting, right away, what's the reaction? What do people, now the rock that they had hauled up is broken open. Now what? Now what do they do?
Well, it was astonishment, really. What they saw was traces of gear wheels, sort of cogs like you would find, you know, in clockwork, inside a clock. It was covered in these tiny, tiny inscriptions, so writing all over it. Very difficult to read, but you could see the traces that writing was there. And also signs of dials, sort of precisely marked dials and pointers. So it's what you've got is something that looks like it was a clockwork mechanism, and something was being displayed on these dials, and that is completely not what you would expect to find from the ancient world. And the ancient Greeks weren't supposed to be particularly good at technology. You know, they had this amazing philosophy, amazing sculpture, but the historians thought of them as not particularly technically minded, and. Also, in terms of these gear wheels, no single gear wheel had ever been found from the ancient world. Apart from the Antikythera mechanism, they still haven't. We don't have one. This thing has at least 30. So it's sort of miles away from anything else that we know about. In terms of the dials and the pointers, there's no other example of a precisely marked sort of scientific scale either. This is the only one. So it really was completely outside the experience of any of the experts at the museum, and they called in experts from all over Europe, actually, to have a look at it, who all came up with their own theories as to what this thing might possibly have been.
Well, we'll talk about those different theories in just a second, but that's very key what Joe is saying right there. So there was no invention like it ever discovered before this, or for that matter, since. It just appears in the timeline of history, and we'll talk about the Antikythera mechanism decoding the heavens on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're decoding the heavens tonight on Coast to Coast AM. You can link up to Joe Marchant at coasttocoastam.com, too. And, you know, so if you're just joining us here, this amazing rock breaks open, and they discover inside there are gears. And this is what year was it when the rock cracked open?
This was 1901. Now.
Okay, so we're in 1901 since this shipwreck was discovered off the coast of the remote Greek island of Antikythera. Right away they know that there are gears in it, but their first thought is, well, this couldn't have come from the same period as the statues, because there were no known gears in the ancient world.
Yeah, there was a whole range of opinions, but some thought it was a very clever hoax. Some thought that perhaps it was a later device that had been dropped on the site of the shipwreck, you know, hundreds of years later by chance. They just couldn't believe that something so sophisticated could have been made by the Greeks so long ago.
So they started dating it as late as somewhere in the fourth century AD. I mean, they started thinking of this as something, because there's no way that they had anything this sophisticated back when these statues were being made. So, you know, that's part of what they're having to getting over is sort of looking at this device with a certain amount of technological prejudice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was, like I said, there was a range. I mean, some of them thought that perhaps it was just simpler than it appeared or something, and maybe it was older, and some of them thought, no, it must have been later. But, yeah, again, there was a range of dates, and one of the dates that was mentioned was 4th century AD. But still, that would have been, you know, way ahead of any other technology that we knew about for the time.
And you mentioned before that you said there was like 30-some-odd wheels and gears inside of this box, but some people speculate there might have been at one point twice as many as that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Now that the mechanism has been reconstructed, it does seem fairly clear that we don't have all of it. So at least 30 gear wheels survive, but it looks as though there may have been, yes, perhaps the same number again on the front of the device, which are now missing. And researchers have some ideas about what those gear wheels were doing. But, you know, without them actually surviving, we can't know for sure.
People can look at what it looked like when they hauled it off the ocean online. But describe what it would have looked like back when it was originally made, the size of it and the look of it when the Antikythera mechanism was originally, when the last nail went into it originally.
So it was in a rectangular wooden box, perhaps about a foot tall, a bit less, maybe a bit like a clock that you might have on your mantelpiece. So reasonably portable. So you've got this wooden case, and there's a wooden handle on the side, and you operate the mechanism inside by turning that handle. And then there are dials on the front and on the back. So there was one big dial on the front with pointers that went around it, and then on the back there were two dials, one above the other. And these weren't circular dials. The ones on the back were actually spiral dials with pointers, like sort of extendable pointers going around, a bit like the stylus on a record player with an extendable arm that goes all the way around the spiral, and then you can reset it back to the beginning once you get to the end.
You describe something that's about the size of a modern computer stack for a desktop computer.
Yes, I suppose you could say that, yeah.
And so portable, and we can't know whether the ancient Romans who would have taken this from whatever Greek location they found it, we can't know if they knew what they had.
Yeah, it's not clear whether they just thought, that looks interesting, we're having that, stole it, didn't know what it was. Or it is possible that it was being shipped to a particular wealthy owner. I mean, the Romans did love Greek culture, and there was trade also going on between the two cultures. As I said before, this thing was covered in inscriptions, and it looks as though those inscriptions were actually a bit like operating instructions. So that it was very step-by-step kind of dummy's guide to what each of the pointers did. So it could be that it was made by somebody for a sort of wealthy owner, because this would have cost a lot of money, this device, but made for somebody who didn't have that expert knowledge and then would have needed those instructions to kind of, you know, work out how to use it.
And the inscriptions are very important because they have to appear obviously very small, and they're engraved on these pieces in a very careful and very professional way.
Yeah, so there were sort of bronze flat plates kind of fixed onto the front and the back of the mechanism, sort of, you know, above and below and around the dials, and that's where the inscriptions appear. And they're very small, the lettering, there's a few different sizes, but most of it just a few millimeters high, packed in very closely. And at this time as well, they didn't have spaces between their words. So that's been a bit of a headache for researchers trying to decipher the inscriptions as well. But, you know, just basically the lettering crammed in as small as you can get it, and a very precise, careful hand as well. Somebody really cared about this who was inscribing those letters.
Well, and I think that just adds to the fact that whoever created it knew that what they were creating was something very special and very unique.
Yeah, well, this was a luxury item. So this wasn't an everyday device. It was well made, you know, good quality materials that had gone into it, very high level of craftsmanship. It wasn't necessarily, although it's unique for us now, it wasn't necessarily unique at the time, just because you couldn't make something as sophisticated as this as a one-off. I mean, you would have needed probably a whole tradition of that type of technology, building on it and building on it, to come up with something like this. But it would have been, if not a one-off, then, you know, a very, very special piece of work.
Okay. I want to pick at that a little bit, because in Decoding the Heavens, you talk about this. There is no precedent for this invention. We don't see, if you say, you know, this would have been building on the technology and building on the technology in order to get where they got with this box, we don't have any of these other boxes.
Yeah, well, that's what's kind of so mind-blowing about this in a way, because this tells us that there was a whole tradition of this kind of device. And yet, until we found the Antikythera mechanism, we were completely ignorant of it. So it's not that we've just missed one machine. You know, we've missed this whole tradition, which really does make you think about what else we've missed.
Well, and so let's go back to that. Since we've found the Antikythera mechanism and we know that there is such a thing as this, or that this had been used, have we been able to find any other ones?
Nope. If you look sort of further in the historical record, and I don't know if you want to talk about this now, I'll go into this later, we see anything like this for hundreds of years afterwards. The next time you see something anything close is the 6th century AD, so that's sort of probably 700 years later. And it's, although it's a similar principle, it's nowhere near as sophisticated. It's just a handful of gear wheels. So if you look through time, nothing. But there's nothing else from the ancient world anything close. But we can look at texts and sort of see hints in ancient writings that something like this was going on.
Okay, so I want to unpack that a little bit. In fact, I thought you said that there was maybe until the 1700s, there isn't even a clock that's made that's as sophisticated as the Antikythera mechanism.
That's right. I mean, to get something as sophisticated as this, there are clocks probably around the 13th century. But they're much bigger. To get something as sophisticated as this and as small as this, because it's hard to make things that small, then you're probably looking at the 17th century. So you don't see the equivalent again for, you know, well over 1,000 years later, more than that.
Okay, and so that's why I want to challenge you a little bit and say, okay, there is no known discovery. There are no other examples of this Antikythera mechanism. There's nothing that we have in the archaeological record leading up to this box, and there's nothing after it for, you know, 600 more years, and that's even a rudimentary version of something that had already been more sophisticated that existed 600 years earlier. Why can't we draw from that, or why can't we make one theoretical claim that this really was a one-off, that there may not have been a tradition of a lot of these around, and that just one person might have made one of these, and then there wasn't another one. Maybe they died, maybe they got hit by an ox cart, who knows, and they never made another one again, and it ends up, that's why nobody knows exactly what it is, and it ends up falling into the hands of the Romans centuries later.
I mean, we can't say for certain, because we weren't there and we don't know what happened, but there are several lines of evidence why I would argue that that's not likely to be the case. So one of them, as I was saying, is just the sophistication, the idea that one person from nothing could have reached this level if they were building on, you know, building the entire principle and idea of this from scratch in terms of both the technology and the information that it was encoding, I think is very unlikely. You probably would have needed generations of workmen, each building on the work of the ones before. So that's one argument. Another argument is based on statistics. If you look at how little survives from the ancient world, just a very, very tiny fraction of the items that were made, and especially something like this, it was made of bronze, the internal working, so that was a precious metal. And anything made of bronze in later years tended to be melted down and recycled and turned into something else. Things like that just don't tend to survive. So if you look at statues, for example, we know that there were hundreds of thousands of bronze statues standing in the streets of the ancient Greek world, but maybe more than that, maybe millions. Now, one of the biggest collections of those statues in the world is at the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and they have just 10. Nine of those are from shipwrecks. So for this type of thing, made of bronze, unless it's, you know, at the bottom of the sea, out of reach, in a shipwreck, they just don't survive. So, you know, we have a handful out of hundreds of thousands or millions in terms of statues. So for the Antikythera mechanism, if it had been a one-off, what are the chances that that one would have sank on a shipwreck and we would have found it? I think it's tiny. I think there would have to have been more than that for us to have a chance of finding just one.
I see I see the statistical argument, but I think there's an element to that I would throw at you.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be this, that the statues served no function other than beauty or cultural preservation. And theoretically, the Antikythera mechanism, and we haven't really talked about what it can do yet, but as an early form of a computer, you would have thought that something that would have had value. And so as a device that could predict the heavens, that would be something that would have been elevated in its importance and not just looked upon as the sum of its, you know, as a collection of parts.
Well, that's certainly true in the culture in which it was made, that the knowledge there would have been valued. But later on, you know, as the Romans took over, then, you know, Greek science wasn't valued as much, wasn't built on as much. And then even more so when the Roman Empire collapsed, you know, all of that knowledge was gone, basically. People didn't care about astronomy or computers or, you know, science or philosophy or anything like that. It would have literally, they would have looked upon it as, this metal is worth something, I'm going to melt it down and sell it. You know, that's for most of Europe, through the Dark Ages, you know, that would have been how it was seen. So it would have had no more value than a statue.
Hmm.
There's one more line of evidence I wanted to mention, actually, in terms of why... Why do we think that this wasn't a one-off? And that is, if you look at writings from the time, so in particular there's a Roman writer called Cicero. He was a lawyer and a politician, but
sure.
He also wrote a lot on Greek philosophy. And
sure.
He mentioned a couple of stories of bronze models of the heavens that as they turned would predict the motions of what was going on in the sky, which is, I guess we'll get to later, is similar to what's going on with the Antikythera mechanism. And these stories, and there were some other writers that mentioned them as well, just sort of passing references, and they were never taken very seriously by historians because these writers didn't give any technical details. There weren't any drawings. They didn't explain how these things would have worked. It was thought to be beyond the Greeks. So, you know, the historians thought, well, you know, maybe Cicero made this up to make a point. You know, without the actual hard evidence, you don't want to assume stuff. You know, it's just a mention of something. It could have been a fancy. But now that we have the Antikythera mechanism, there's an actual object saying, actually, these stories are true. They really did make those things. And so then you can look at some of the different references to items made by different people and say, okay, so perhaps there was the tradition there.
All true. So then we set the table, I think, well enough for people to get a better idea as to what it did. What did all of these gears and wheels and handles, what did it give? What information could it provide as accurately as we can today?
I'm not sure there's anything quite as accurate as we can today, but it was incredibly accurate, especially for the time. So, I mean, this has taken 100 years for researchers to work out what this thing does. But briefly, as we've hinted, it was predicting the motions of the heavens. One name that's been given to it is a calendar computer. So the big circular dial on the front was basically showing you the motions of the sun and the moon and almost certainly the five known planets. The five planets that the Greeks knew about through the year. So you had one dial giving you the months of the year, and another dial showing the signs of the zodiac. So these are sort of two concentric rings going around, and then the pointers for the sun and the moon and the planets. And then on the back, the two spirals, you've got a calendar, a 19-year calendar, which is basically bringing together the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. And then you've got a second one, which is predicting eclipses. So it's telling you exactly which month to expect an eclipse, whether it's going to be a lunar eclipse or a solar eclipse, what time it's going to happen, how long the eclipse is going to last, all kinds of information like that. And then also in the inscriptions, you have a star calendar. So depending on the time of the year, it's telling you exactly what to expect in terms of which stars are rising and setting at dawn and at sunset. So you, as you turn the handle, you're basically winding forwards or backwards in time. And for any moment in time, you can look at the dials, and it's telling you everything that you need to know about the sky, where the sun is, where the moon is, where the planets are, whether there's an eclipse, what the date is, all of that stuff.
Well, and you used the word exactly in there, which is what I was keying on before. That, so help me understand, what is it, I mean, other than the fact that they couldn't know all of the planets that they knew, what did they get wrong?
Well, it kind of comes from the way that they saw how the solar system is arranged. So now, of course, we know that the planets are all revolving around the sun. We have a heliocentric view of the solar system. But the Greeks mostly, not all of them, saw everything as revolving around the Earth. And obviously, because the planets are going around the sun and not around us, as we look at the planets, they don't seem to be going in regular paths through the sky as we look at them. And the Greeks had various theories to account for this. One's called an epicyclic theory. So they imagine the planets as looping the loop, almost doing little circles as they traveled in their bigger circles. So as far as their theories were concerned, this was very accurate, but not probably quite as accurate as we know today.
Okay. That's the Antikythera mechanism to a degree. The other question is then who made the Antikythera mechanism, and what do we think was, or how do we think it might have been used in the culture? I mean, we'll get back to this coming up after the top of the hour, but we all remember a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, right? And the key scene where he pulls out the old farmer's almanac and predicts the eclipse. What if that box had existed? They were predicting eclipses long before that. But that's technology that gets lost in the Dark Ages. And there's more to this story about how even the Antikythera mechanism gets lost again, so to speak, right after World War II, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Joe Marchant, the author of Decoding the Heavens, talking about the Antikythera mechanism. So what year do we think it was built, and who do we think might have built it?
Okay, well, the most accurate date that we have for the ship that it was on when it went down actually comes from some coins that were found at the wreck site by Jacques Cousteau, and he went back there in the 1970s, and they date from between 70 and 60 BC. So that means that the mechanism cannot have been made later than that. But looking at the inscriptions, when researchers have looked at the style of the writing, because the lettering kind of changes through the decades, they've kind of estimated perhaps around 100 BC, or maybe even a little earlier, for the date of the mechanism itself. So that's not an exact certain date. They haven't actually found a date on the device itself, but from the lettering, probably around 100 BC, so well over 2,000 years old. In terms of who might have made it, again, it's not signed, although they are still reading the inscriptions. They haven't all been read yet, so it's still possible that we might find a signature on it, which would be very nice. But there are some sort of hints, some circumstantial evidence, if you like, as to who might have made it.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a couple of schools of thought on that, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So one of them concerns a guy called Posidonius. He was a philosopher, one of the most respected philosophers in the Greek world. He lived in the first century BC, and he lived on Rhodes, actually. He had a school there, and he was there at exactly the time that the ship on which the mechanism was found sailed. And as we talked about before, it almost certainly stopped off at Rhodes. So he would have been there when this ship stopped at the island. And the reason that he is implicated is that in the stories that Cicero tells, so when he's written about these bronze models of the heavens, one of them, he says, our friend Posidonius has made, and then goes on to describe this bronze model. And he says, you know, as you turn the handle, it shows you the revolutions of the sun and the moon and the planets every day and every night. So very similar sort of thing to the Antikythera mechanism. So we don't know if Posidonius could have made this exact device, but he was certainly interested and involved in making that kind of machine. So the fact that he was there on Rhodes at the time is very compelling, really. So we know that he was very interested in astronomy. And also with with his philosophy as well. He was a Stoic philosopher, and they believed in a divine life force that infused the whole cosmos. So as part of his philosophy, he was very interested in understanding exactly how the heavens worked. So something like this would have been very interesting to him. So that's one school of thought. But there's another one. Some of the other stories that have been written about this kind of device, they actually cite Archimedes, the famous mathematician, as making this kind of thing. He came from Syracuse, which was on the island of Sicily, and he actually lived too early. He was a couple of hundred years earlier, so he couldn't have made this particular device. But it's possible that he could have been perhaps the original inventor of this kind of mechanism. So as I said, it was something that was being built on over the generations. So maybe Archimedes was behind it all originally. And another reason for thinking that is that when you look at the month names on the Antikythera mechanism itself, different cities had different sort of month names that they used. And the months on the Antikythera mechanism are very close to the ones that were used in Syracuse, in Sicily. So you've got a link there as well that's implicating Archimedes.
Weren't they the months that were on the mechanism, or in that era from the Greek tradition, weren't they essentially Grecian versions of Egyptian months? Were they using the Egyptian calendar?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different sort of calendars on there. So there's a dial on the front, and this was an astronomical dial. This is the one showing you the sun, the moon, and the planets as they move around the sky. And the month names on there are from an astronomical calendar. And yes, these are the Greek sort of translations, if you like, of the months used in an Egyptian astronomical calendar. But then on the back, you've got another calendar, this 19-year calendar, and that's got different month names on it. And what's interesting about this one is that these were not the sort of month names that an astronomer would have used, but this was a civic calendar that would have just been used by ordinary people to track time. And that's interesting because it's saying this isn't just an astronomer's tool. This is something that was meant for lay people, probably educated people, but lay people. And those are the month names that implicate Syracuse in Sicily, because each different town would have had its own set of months that it used.
And so maybe this is a good time to just list as best as you can all of the things that the Antikythera mechanism could do. Okay. You mentioned earlier some of the, you know, the lunar shifts and the eclipses, but especially if we're able to make what could you adjust it to do? What was its total flexibility, do we think?
Okay, I mean, it wasn't something that you could program to do different things. So there was just one handle, and you could
right.
move forward and backwards in time using that, and then you would look at all the different dials for the different bits of information. On the front, so this is the one, as I was saying, where you've got pointers showing you the movements of the sun, the moon, and the planets around the sky as time passes. And they're not just moving around at a constant speed. It's not just a simple train of gears where you turn the handle and you get different speeds of motion. You've actually got very complicated gear wheels in there, including trains of gear wheels riding around on other gear wheels. There's different layers to it, which are actually modeling the varying speed of the sun and the moon as we see them from Earth, and also the wandering motion of the planets. So the pointers will move forward, they'll move backwards to model what's happening in the sky. So that's pretty impressive. There was also a little ball, a little rotating ball. It was painted half black, half silver, and that rotated to show you the phase of the moon as well as you turn the handle. And then, as I said, you've got all of these inscriptions that you can refer to that are telling you what's happening with the stars, the constellations at different times of year. So that's the front.
Yep.
On the back, you've got these two dials. So the top one is a spiral. It's divided into 235 months, and so each of those 235 divisions has got a month name inscribed on it. That takes you through 19 years. And the reason that it was 235 months is because although in 1 year you don't have exactly 12 lunar months, the sort of motions of the sun and the moon unfortunately don't match up nicely like that. You know, our calendar is based on the movements of the sun, but the Greeks wanted a calendar that would tell them the movements of the sun and the movements of the moon, because the moon was important to them for various religious festivals. And actually, over 235 months, the movements of the moon, the cycles of the moon, do fit exactly into 19 years. So that's why they had a repeating calendar of 19 years. Then within that dial, you had yet another smaller dial, and that was divided into four. And what's been discovered very recently is that that was actually telling you the location of the different Greek games. So it was a four-year cycle, and you had, so, the Olympic Games. It would tell you which year the Olympic Games were being held, which we're all familiar with. But there were other Greek games as well that were either held every 2 years or every 4 years. So you also had that. You could look at it and say, okay, which are the games that are being held this year? And it would tell you the location. And that's interesting as well, because that's not an astronomical thing. The astronomers didn't care. That's a social thing. So, again, this is something that, you know, ordinary people, not necessarily scientists, would have used. And the last dial on the bottom of the back, this is another spiral. This is 223 months this time, which is 18 years, and that was the eclipse prediction dial, because eclipses tend to repeat in a cycle of 18 years, 223 months. So this is the dial where you would have inscribed on the little different month divisions which month to expect an eclipse, what type of eclipse, and lots of information about that eclipse. And there was actually a smaller dial inside that one as well, which converted that into a longer 54-year cycle. So that's pretty much it.
Well, that's a lot. And looking at that, though, in my mind, I'm trying to picture, when you're turning the crank to find out where the position of the planets and the moon in the future, can you turn it backward and it would tell you where the planets and the moons were in the moon was in the past?
Absolutely, yes. So you can go forwards in time, and you can go backwards in time.
That's kind of key, because that shows that it really was about knowledge as opposed to something that wouldn't have served a purpose on the deck of a ship. To know what the planet, where the planets were 4 years ago, didn't mean anything. If that's one of the arguments you would use to say this was not a navigational device, they weren't using this on the ship on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, it's been one theory since this was discovered. You know, it was on a ship. Was it a navigational device? But now that we know what it did, although it's, you know, it's incredibly impressive, it's hard to see how that would have been of use in navigation. And it does seem much more likely that this wasn't part of the ship's instruments. This was part of the cargo. This was one of the treasures, along with all the statues and everything else that was there.
So what would have been the purpose? Who would have likely have had, and how would it have been used, this ancient computer?
Okay, well, I mean, there are a couple of different theories about this as well. So one of them is, was this an astrological device? Was this used for casting horoscopes? So astrology was beginning to become very popular at around this time in Greece, particularly because this astronomy was just enabling people to predict the motions of the planets, and that's very key for astrology. So if you think about it, if you want to cast a horoscope for a particular person and you know exactly when they were born, this would enable you to wind backwards in time to that exact moment of their birth, and you would be able to read off exactly where everything in the sky was at that moment. So that's perfect for a horoscope. So that could have been the purpose, although when you look at the inscriptions beyond the signs of the zodiac, which were used by astronomers as well, there aren't any particular astrological references. So you can't rule out that idea. But there isn't anything else that says, okay, this was being used for horoscopes.
And the Olympic Games wouldn't seem to have any bearing at all on the horoscope thing. It just, maybe it was a nice little side feature, but it didn't seem germane to the astrological prediction.
Exactly, yeah. So it's possible, but I don't think that was probably what was going on. There's another idea, which is that this was a philosophical or religious demonstration of the workings of the heavens. So just something almost like an educational tool, but more than an educational tool, a kind of, you know, a way spiritually of getting closer to the workings of the universe, to the true meaning of things, if you like. So I mentioned the philosopher Posidonius earlier, and in his school of philosophy, they saw the universe as infused with this divine life force. You know, the heavens really were divine. So to understand the workings of that was almost like getting closer to God, if you like. And interestingly, when Cicero wrote about this kind of device, the reason he wrote about it was to make a particular argument. And his argument was, when we look at this model of the heavens, we know we can see for sure that it must have been made by an intelligent maker. So therefore, when we look at the universe, which works in the same way, surely that had an intelligent maker as well. It's kind of an early version of intelligent design, if you like.
Yeah,
so
I
there was
totally
clearly some religious significance there for them.
And what are other popular theories for the use or the and even how this device was displayed or consumed?
Well, those are the main two in terms of why did they want to have a device like this. There are still questions over, you know, was this definitely turned by hand, or perhaps could it have been attached to a water clock? So if you had so water clocks were popular at the time, and so perhaps the handle could have been turned by water, and so it would have been, you know, part of a bigger display.
Sure.
Probably.
So that would have been a public display. You're thinking about something in a town square or something that a bit of regional pride or state pride or city pride about it.
Absolutely. I mean, in Athens, for example, around the same time, there was a building built called the Tower of the Winds, which we know was a huge water clock which drove a big bronze disc that turned at the same time as the heavens. And this was a big display piece that would have been the center of the marketplace. So perhaps the Antikythera mechanism was something similar. Personally, I think that they may have had things like this, perhaps bigger displays that were hooked up to water clocks. But the Antikythera mechanism itself, it's in this handy little wooden case, and I think that probably was almost like a travel version. You know, it was portable, so probably would have been taken from place to place and worked by hand. The other thing that we can say about it is, as I was hinting before, although this was probably made by somebody who had state-of-the-art astronomical knowledge as well as the technical expertise, it was probably made for an educated but lay audience. It would have been a very expensive luxury gadget that would have been bought by a wealthy owner to show off to their friends or to other people that they know, almost like a high-status gadget that they could have.
But then also that wouldn't preclude a school that would be having something like this as maybe a central feature to its attractiveness to prospective students. You could this could have fallen into, you know, a mathematical school, like an Archimedean sort of school system or something, where they would be teaching this, and this would, so an educational tool, as you said, but for a very specific audience.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we know that Posidonius did have a school on Rhodes. So maybe it was the sort of their prized possession. Back in those times, they didn't really differentiate sort of astronomy from philosophy. It was all part of the same thing. So this could well have been a teaching tool in a very sort of elite school, yes.
You want to hear my theory?
Yeah, go for it.
And remember, I am the dumbest guy I know. So this isn't a very informed theory, but it's sort of a hybrid a little bit of a couple of things. I'm very fond of the ancient world, and I'm always curious about how they viewed the importance of astronomy, or even perhaps astrology, and what they would do nationally. So when you were talking about the device in the book Decoding the Heavens, about it, whether or not it was some sort of personal astrological device, I wonder whether it could have been a national astrological device. That this would have been a way which they could say, if we were going to go to war, this would be the date to do it. If the king were to do something, what would be that perfect time, predicting ahead with the king's advisors, where they would say, this would be the time to do that? What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, there wasn't necessarily a country of Greece at the time. There was
right, they were city-states.
But,
right.
But, yeah, within a particular community, this could have been, yeah, the sort of the leader's advisory tool. Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
But because we don't know where it came from yet, we don't know to whom it might have appealed. And if we knew more about the actual origin of the Antikythera mechanism, we might know the royal court that it could have been used in. And if we knew that they were a particularly warring nation, or they were a nation, a city state, as it were, if they were always involved in those sorts of intrigues, that might be a very valuable thing for the advisors to the throne, as it were. That's my theory. That's what I'm throwing out. We'll come back to Decoding the Heavens. Joe Marchant is the author. It's just fascinating. It's a great book. And I mentioned before that, you know, this device was in existence. We know that. And then it kind of it disappears. And we enter into what we call the Dark Ages. Well, this device itself entered into a dark age again, even after its discovery. We'll talk about that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. It kind of gets discovered and then undiscovered and then rediscovered again. It's the Antikythera mechanism, this early computer. Joe Marchant wrote the book on that. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. And I thought that was interesting that, you know, here are all these great antiquities in Greece, and then here come the Nazis.
Yeah, that's quite a story as well. So, yeah, so in Athens, basically, during the Second World War, the German army is advancing on the city. Everyone's trying to get out, the government flee. And at the museum, they basically buried the exhibits under the floor. They knew that they had to try and safeguard all of these, amazing historical treasures. So that's what they did. They lifted up the stone slabs and buried it under the floor. And that's how a lot of the museum's content survived the Second World War. And that included the Antikythera mechanism.
Yeah, but then out of sight, out of mind again. I mean, it's not like the Antikythera mechanism, not fully understood yet. It wasn't as sexy as a lot of the statues. So the statues were the first to start getting displayed again. And it's like, oh, yeah, that thing. We forgot about that thing.
Yeah, so the museum reopened after the war, and things were gradually put back on display again. As you say, all of the statues and your sort of traditional ancient Greek treasures, what you would think of. But the Antikythera mechanism, no one had really figured out what it was. It was kind of this odd thing that didn't really make much sense. And so it was just left in a storage crate again in a back room. It wasn't put back on display because nobody had really come up with an answer. And this has actually been a problem for the Antikythera mechanism until just a few years ago, actually. It hasn't been taken that seriously. It hasn't been seen as, it hasn't been given the significance it deserves because historians have this view of history, of what the Greeks were able to achieve. This doesn't fit. And so it has been ignored to a large extent. And what hasn't helped is, one of the other theories surrounding this thing is, it's far too sophisticated to have been from that time. People couldn't possibly have made it. It must have been aliens. And the author Eric von Daniken has written about the Antikythera mechanism. He believed it was a navigational device used on alien spaceships. So that's kind of added to this feeling that this is kind of an oddball, weird thing, doesn't really need to be taken seriously by mainstream historians.
Well, I think that's the key word here is mainstream historians. But at least, God bless Eric von Daniken, at least he was taking it seriously. At least somebody was.
He took it seriously. I don't know if I would agree with his interpretation of it.
Fair enough.
But Arthur C. Clarke as well, I mean, he took it seriously. He was one of the few people who has championed this thing throughout the 20th century. He featured it in his TV programs. He wrote about it. And for him, it was a reminder not to take the ancient people for granted, and showed us how clever they really were. And for him, that was the kind of the wonder of this device. So I would agree more with Arthur C. Clarke. And he actually wrote that it's kind of it's quite eerie, really. And he was saying, if they'd been able to build on this device, he believed that we could have had the Industrial Revolution more than 1,000 years ago, and that by now we wouldn't just be going to the moon, we'd be pottering around the nearby stars. That was a quote from one of the lectures he gave. So that was the significance that he attached to this thing.
Well, I so see that. In fact, it's hard to believe I get a kick out of von Daniken, and I think he's I like a lot of the work he did, and I think he's taken very seriously on some of the ancient ships and some of the work done from Egypt to the New World, and I think there's some very cool things that he did. In this case, though, you would have thought, just to take that, theory seriously for a second, is that if somebody were coming from outer space, they would know that there were more than five planets.
Yes, I think they probably would if they'd got this far. And also the astronomical theories that are encoded in the device very much fit with what we know the Greeks believed at the time. It was state of the art. It was, you know, the absolute height of the science, but it does fit with what the Greeks were doing. And the inscriptions as well, like, why would the aliens inscribe in ancient Greek of exactly the style of the time? You know, that doesn't fit really for me either.
Well, and what we could surmise from that, if we were to take that theory seriously, is that some ancient civilization thought it was very important to make it to at least some of the Greek Olympic Games.
Yeah,
right? They built that device in there so that they know when the games are coming, so that they could quick hurry over and the games are coming and they could come down for that. It wouldn't seem to fit. Now, when he had his theories about this being an alien device, was that before the discovery of that particular wheel that would have predicted the Olympic Games?
Yeah, we didn't know about the Olympiad dial when Eric von Daniken was writing about this.
Yeah.
So you can let him off that one.
he might have thought twice about that theory before.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that because they didn't take it seriously, we don't know how much damage was done to the mechanism. You know, if they pulled something like that out of the sea today, they would have all sorts of ways of encasing it in plaster and keeping it from decaying and all these other things. They just didn't do that back then. So there was a lot of damage done to this just by yanking it out of the water, sticking it in a crate and taking it to a museum.
Yeah, I mean, marine archaeology didn't really exist as a field at this time. So it was about salvaging as many treasures as possible rather than having any scientific understanding. So as I said, this thing is in bits. There are three quite large bits, and those are the photos that are on the website, but there are also lots and lots of much smaller pieces as well. And we don't know if it was brought up in bits or whether it came up in one piece and has broken into pieces since. I was saying before, when it cracked open, it may well have been because someone just hit the rock with a hammer to see what was inside. That was perfectly standard practice at the time.
Right. Exactly.
And also the fact that it was left in this outdoor courtyard for so long. So chemical reactions were eating the bronze away for months before anybody realized what this thing was. And it's possible still that there are more pieces of this, because we don't have all of it, sitting in the storeroom in the Athens Museum. Every few years, somebody does find another bit.
Right.
So that may well still be the case.
And just as it is, it's been said that shepherds were the earliest biblical archaeologists. I guess it would be fair to say that sponge divers were the original marine archaeologists.
Yeah, I suppose, that's true. I mean, they were the ones that were discovering wrecks, and that, you know, some of the very earliest things we have from the sea were brought up by divers, a few by fishermen as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that kind of accidental discovery, there was no other way. If you didn't throw a hook on it by accident, get it caught in a net, or bring it up because you were diving for sponges, you wouldn't have known it was there as you were on the surface. So perhaps there should be a special place for sponge divers in the Marine Archaeology Hall of Fame or a museum, because it's pretty amazing to think that that kind of fundamental thing often leads to the greatest discoveries. And so it is, too, with the modern example of the Nazis coming for it. I'm reminded of the Romans, right? Who that was the model. They Romans conquered, and then they took what they wanted from the conquered territories, and then here come the Nazis, who conquered and then took what they wanted from that. But they didn't get the Antikythera mechanism this time, because they were clever enough to hide it from them. And one wonders, as you said before, if you go back to that period where, if this could have been taken seriously earlier, where we might have been. You mentioned the Arthur C. Clarke theory. I'm curious about that, too. So we know for sure that there's no mention of this mechanism beyond a certain point in history. I mean, they're just after that period where it would have gone down in the shipwreck. Is there nothing mentioned in the first or second centuries that say, oh, we still have this planetary predicting device?
Nothing really that we know of. I mean, as I was saying before, that doesn't mean that it wasn't there and so little survives. But in terms of what we have, no more devices like this, no more mentions in text. There was one, I think it's around the 3rd century AD, there's a Roman mathematician, and he was talking about different professions, and he mentions the profession of sphere makers. And sphere was the word that was used when people were talking about these kinds of devices earlier. And it doesn't necessarily mean a literal sphere, but they tended to use it for sort of astronomical devices. So there's a kind of hint there that maybe there are people that are making this sort of thing. But that's it. There is nothing else until the 6th century AD, where we have, it's a sundial, actually, and sundials were reasonably common in Greek and Roman times.
Sure.
But there's one that's very special. Basically, a Lebanese guy, walked into the Science Museum in London in 1983 with some battered old pieces in his pocket and said, walked up to a security guard, asked if he could see one of the curators there, and then said, oh, I've got something here you might be interested in buying. And it turned out to be this 6th century sundial from the Byzantine Empire, which is the eastern part of the Roman Empire when it's split into two, Greek-speaking. But it wasn't an ordinary sundial. It had 8 gear wheels, and they formed a little calendar that showed you the movements of the sun and the moon through the zodiac, and there was also a little window showing you the phase of the moon and the day of the month. So, you know, sounds familiar. It's exactly the same principle as the Antikythera mechanism, except instead of, you know, well over 30 wheels and all of this complicated astronomical calculations that's going on, this is very simple. It's just 8 gear wheels, just the sun and the moon, just constant speeds of rotation. So this suggests that the tradition or the principle of this kind of thing has survived, but much of the knowledge had been lost. It had really sort of decayed down. But the other interesting thing about the sundial is this wasn't a luxury gadget. This was just more roughly made, cheaper materials. So this could have been quite an everyday thing. There could have been quite a lot of these things around.
You know, if the Antikythera mechanism was the first desktop computer, then this was the first pocket calculator.
Yes, I guess you could put it that way. So this could have been something that a lot of people would have carried with them, and would have had a very practical use. After this particular piece, so this is suggesting that at least the principle of this kind of technology survives into the Byzantine Empire. Then we see nothing again for another 400 or 500 years, and then around 1000 AD in the Islamic world, we see a couple of astrolabes, well, one astrolabe and then some descriptions of astrolabes with exactly the same geared calendar attached to them. So an astrolabe is a very simple sort of astronomical calculator. It's kind of one metal disc that revolves on top of another to sort of simulate the movement of the sky. But then these had attached to them the same 8 gear wheel calendar showing you the sun, the moon, the phase of the moon, exactly the same layout of gear wheels. So this knowledge, again, has survived from the Byzantine Empire into the Islamic world. So although the Antikythera mechanism, a lot of the knowledge was lost, this kernel of the technology has survived through history.
And you wouldn't have thought, because they were not heliocentric, that you would have thought that wouldn't have been a threat into the Dark Ages, where, you know, we know that later astronomers that argued for the Earth evolving around the sun ran into problems. The Antikythera mechanism would have actually reinforced that idea, that the Church would have endorsed that mechanism if it had survived. There wouldn't have been any reason for them to suppress it anyway.
No, I don't think to suppress it in that way. But to have something like this, like the Antikythera mechanism, so this would have been, you know, hundreds of man hours to make it. You know, you need very sort of sophisticated astronomy to put into it. You need the technical skills. You need the materials. So you need a certain kind of culture to make something like this. And right. Then when the Romans took over, the science wasn't really being built upon. It became sort of increasingly degenerate. When the Roman Empire collapsed, everything became much poorer. Knowledge wasn't valued. So you just wouldn't have had this thing being made. And then also with the church in general, there was this feeling that all knowledge that was worth having came from God, should come from God. It was almost blasphemous to be inquiring about the natural world, to be using scientific methods to look at the way things work. You didn't need to do that. You could just look in the Bible. So from that point of view, this whole sort of philosophy behind this kind of device wouldn't really have thrived in that environment.
But understood in its entirety, the Stoic model of that sort of intelligent design would have been consistent with that if they had known what was behind the if we're correct in wondering whether or not this device was intended to sort of be, if you will, a divine predictor, a predictor of the heavens, that wouldn't have been inconsistent with the church.
In some ways, not. But I think for the Greeks, although looking at the heavens had religious significance, you could learn about it by making scientific observations. So you could do experiments, make predictions, make observations. And that was all very much in line with a kind of religious way of looking at the world. But later, during the Dark Ages, it wasn't so much. You know, you would look back to the Bible. You wouldn't. There wasn't any need to go out and make your own observations, if that makes any sense.
Well, I would be more afraid of that being perceived as some sort of box of witchcraft, or, you know, that might have been.
Yeah, all that too.
Yeah, that would have gotten you in trouble, some sort of wizardy sort of thing. Well, as you look forward to, what is it that you think we can learn from the Antikythera mechanism? What is it that, how does that inform how we should be looking back on history?
I think to keep an open mind, first of all. So, I mean, mainstream historians, I think they have to be quite cautious. They don't really acknowledge anything unless we have absolute hard evidence of it. Even if there are hints, you know, they want to see the actual device. But I think that although it's good to be conservative in that way, I think that when we find something completely new and different like this, it does remind us that that's only the tip of the iceberg, you know, the stuff that survives now. And we have to allow for the fact that a whole lot more was going on than we realized. And the other thing is that we shouldn't think of technology as a kind of straight line of progress from, you know, primitive things that were made in ancient times to complicated things that we made now. It's been much more up and down than that, all sorts of different factors coming into play, knowledge being gained, knowledge being lost again. And perhaps we should look upon our own knowledge as slightly more fragile as well. You know, what we have from a technological point of view, there's no reason why that couldn't be lost in the future if we're not careful.
In your research for this mechanism, have you come across any other suspicions, any other, well, how did you describe it, hints at possibilities of other things that are out there that we might be mindful of, that we might hope to discover someday?
It's hard to put give specific examples for that. I think in terms of the gear work and that kind of device, you know, there's no reason why that they couldn't have been using that for other things as well. Also, in terms of, it's kind of quite well known that there was a guy called Hero of Alexandria in the first century AD, and he was making something that was very similar to a modern steam engine, for example. So there are all sorts of different hints there.
That we just haven't found them yet. But we see them written about. We see things that are referenced by other writers.
Yeah, so
but we don't actually have the device yet.
Written about. Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure there's a lot more. Shipwrecks are going to be a really key place to look.
Yeah, but that'll be fun. Well, that's it for me. And I look forward to hearing what your questions are going to be for Joe Marchand, Decoding the Heavens. We've been talking about the Antikythera mechanism, this very fundamental computer made about 2,000 years ago, lost in a shipwreck, rediscovered in 1900 by sponge divers, and then digested over the last 110 years or so until we have the knowledge that we have now. If you haven't seen the pictures for it, go online at coasttocoastam.com, and you see how far we have come in decoding the Antikythera mechanism since it was originally found. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. East of the Rockies, John is in Atlanta for Joe Marchand, Decoding the Heavens on Coast to Coast AM. John?
Good morning, Ian. Good morning to your guest. Forgive me, I haven't heard the whole show tonight, but I just wanted to mention a show. I think it was on the History Channel I saw a few years ago about the Roman Emperor Caligula and this inventor he had working for him, who they considered a complete genius. He invented these devices with multiple moving parts, multiple gears that moved independently, mainly designed for entertainment and artwork. He would put statues on these devices and they would move around and rise up and down. And
right.
He had whole shows and displays with these inventions that he made purely designed for entertainment and art value.
Sort of early robots. I've heard about that. Hey, Joe, where are you on that?
Yeah, I don't know the details of this specifically, but it's certainly true that sort of little figures, automata with moving parts, were very popular in Roman times. So I mentioned Hero of Alexandria in the first century AD. So from him onwards, really. So some of them were steam powered, and there were very simple gears to move the parts sometimes. None of the actual physical objects survive. So again, we know about this from texts, which, you know, it's hard to tell exactly how things worked and exactly what existed or whether things might have been written about but never actually made. But it seems likely that they were doing this. Where the Antikythera mechanism is different, and I think very impressive, is that you're actually using this clockwork to make mathematical calculations, and that's what takes it to a whole new level. So it's not just moving parts in order to make a figure move around, but you're actually doing computation and mathematics with that mechanism. But absolutely, these moving automa were very popular, and actually it fitted into a similar philosophical tradition of you know, wanting to understand and model how things worked, and then to impress other people with that knowledge.
Well, and not to contradict the History Channel, but maybe this guy working for Caligula wasn't that much of a genius if the Antikythera mechanism already existed and other complicated gear wheel systems were already out there. You know, having some figures move around and turn and spin and raise an arm or something like that is actually pretty simple.
Yeah, it could be that, you know, these things are all connected and all part of this same tradition, and this is another offshoot of it. So rather than him being a one-off genius, he is building on the other work that's been done. Right. I think that's perfectly possible.
Right. And then we see it pop up again in the Renaissance with the rebirth of that idea too.
Absolutely.
Ricky's in Louisiana on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant.
Hey, thank you so much for letting me on the show. I've been hearing about this device for so long, but there's one thing I may have missed it early on in the program. If it's some sort of computing device, is it based on the decimal or the binary? Have they determined that yet?
Well, it wouldn't be binary, but I mean, it's a really kind of an interesting question. For how they did the gears, the math that they would have based that on, right, would have been fundamental math. Was there anything complicated about the gear mechanisms and the ratios or anything?
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't binary. So the Greeks didn't really have, I mean, I suppose it would have been closer to decimal, but it wasn't really, you didn't have numbers on it in that way. Getting into sort of the technicalities of the mathematics.
But it would have been a base 10. It would have been a base 10 mathematics system, basic, you know, pre-Arabic, pre-invention of the zero, you know, but your basic base 10 math system, right?
Yeah, I think so. And interestingly, although they weren't supposed to have had the figure zero, one of the researchers who's looked at the Antikythera mechanism actually thinks that he has seen a figure zero on there, in which case it would be the earliest known use of zero by the Greeks. So that's quite interesting as well. But this is analog rather than digital.
Than digital, right. So there would have been no need for a binary. But that's very interesting. If they could prove that a zero existed on that machine, that would change the way we look at the timeline of mathematics.
He thinks that he saw it when he inspected the fragment by eye and kind of looked underneath some sort of accretion products that were on the top of it and thought that he could see this, and he drew it in his notebook. But when a later team went and x-rayed the images, they didn't get to look at it by eye, but they x-rayed it and can't see the figure on their x-rays. So it's kind of a bit of an open question. Did he really see this or did he not?
Terry is in Fresno, California, on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Terry?
Yes, hello. I have a question for Ms. Marchant. The question is, what would she say about comparing the Antikythera mechanism to Su Sung's heavenly clockwork, which was made in China around, I think it was around 1000 AD, and just one little note on that. The reason it was created was because it was important for the emperor to know what was going on in the heavens, because he was the divine representative of God on earth. And so the calendars were very important. And this particular device also has a similar kind of history. It sort of just came along suddenly and also then disappeared rapidly. Then another emperor came along and got rid of it. So I think it is part of a government program to know what's going on in the sky. It's a planetarium.
Okay. Where are you with that, Joe?
This is a really interesting clock tower, actually. And it does, I suppose, support this theory that maybe this could have been something of importance to governments or state rulers. This is around 1000 AD, and it's a huge clock tower, and it's a water clock, basically, or run either by water or mercury. And it was kind of like a water wheel with steps. Buckets would fill with the liquid, and then it would move the clock around another step, and you would have various different spheres and astronomical displays and even little figures that came out and chimed the hours. So this is well over 1,000 years after the Antikythera mechanism. But there are similar sorts of principles in there. Again, you don't have gear work that's making calculations. So there's a very simple gear that's probably translating the movement of the water wheel to turning the spheres. But otherwise, it's just a sphere which has various markings on it, which is rotating as the whole thing turns. So it's fascinating, and it's something else that's way ahead of its time and not well enough known. But still, I would argue that the gear work that's going on in the Antikythera mechanism is in a whole other league.
Well, and just to make the point, the Chinese ruler who later thought himself to be the divine representative on Earth had a different motive than the would have been the leaders of the than the Greek city states where this device was created somewhere, because it wasn't the belief in the Roman divine demigod ruler hadn't happened yet, so there was no sense that the rulers of these city states were divine or semi divine. So in that sense too, it goes back again to, could this have had a national application? Could this have been just a simple, a leader trying to make sure that whatever this leader does on Earth, it has the greatest chance of success based on the movements of the planets and the sun? I'm glad that you didn't laugh that off, because I think it'd be curious to see whether any of the researchers had ever come up with that and then found a reason to think that that wasn't true, that this was a sort of national astrological clock as opposed to an individual astronomical device.
Yeah, it's not something that I've ever seen suggested, so I'm definitely going to go back and ask them if there's a reason why that might not be the case, or whether that's just something that hasn't been considered yet.
I officially label that the Punnett theory until it's been appropriately debunked. Let's go international line, where Rob is in Ontario on Coast to Coast for Joe Marchant. Rob?
Yeah, hi, guys. I was wondering, this technology seems to have appeared out of nowhere, and I wonder if that's an argument for perhaps it having been re-engineered from a much earlier technology. And, of course, what springs to mind there is Atlantis. Has there been any thought along those lines?
I think it was certainly building on earlier technology, whether something could have been developed even earlier and then lost, and then, this was the reappearance that we're seeing in the first century BC. I mean,
Let me tease that out from Rob. Mm-hmm. I think what he's suggesting is that it could have gotten suddenly imported. So maybe it existed in, if let's say there was an Atlantis, let's say as Plato suggested and others have said, there was this very advanced culture, then it's lost. And suddenly it's imported. Somebody that had never once interacted with these Greeks comes in with this technology out of the blue.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about things that are going on so long ago, as I said, we know so little, so it's very hard to rule things out definitely. But I think you want to look at, is there any evidence for that, as opposed to just a story that could possibly be true. In terms of Atlantis, my understanding that the original source of that is a piece of writing by Plato, where he was actually writing a quite sort of political metaphorical tale, and every subsequent reference to Atlantis has come from his original piece of writing, and it's not at all clear that he ever intended Atlantis to be taken seriously as an actual place. He was just making a political point. So whether or not it was Atlantis, I think that's an extremely open question. In terms of whether this could have been imported from somewhere else, in terms of the astronomy, that a lot of that was imported from the Babylonians. So that was what really helped kickstart that side of things. So Babylonian astronomer priests you know, they really care about what was going on in the heavens, because for them it was all about sort of evil omens, especially eclipses that were telling you about bad things that were going to happen. So they had been observing these things for centuries. And so the eclipse knowledge, for example, came from the Babylonians directly. So certainly that's what's going on there. In terms of the actual technology, I mean, it's always possible, but there isn't any evidence. I mean, like I said before, it doesn't mean it wasn't there, but we don't have any particular reason to think that it had come from elsewhere. Archimedes, we know that he was just starting to experiment with the use of gear ratios, and there were writings to do with him making contraptions where you could turn a handle, for example, and then that the force would be sort of multiplied up, and there's a story about him pulling a ship out of the sea with his bare hands. So we know he was experimenting with gear wheels from that point of view. So the idea of building on that then to come up with mathematical gear work does sort of make sense. So I don't know if we need to say, oh, this probably came from a completely different civilization.
Understandable. I just think that is an interesting thought, that it would account for its even sudden with Archimedes, even it could explain that maybe it wasn't a big long ramp up, but like how sometimes happens if a nation, let's use Atlantis just merely as a metaphor, like Plato might have been, and you say that's the Babylonians, that it was proprietary information which suddenly was accessed by other people, and so they never would have let this out. Suddenly it's out, and now everybody's experimenting with it. And so, I mean, that's sort of a, I don't know, it's kind of interesting thought. Because I do think it's interesting that we still don't have any other record. Now, once we come across some other device that predates the Antikythera, I don't know why I'm suddenly having trouble saying that, Antikythera mechanism, then that theory goes out the window. Then we can see another ramp up. But in the meantime, I don't know. So I'm sort of intrigued by that sort of thing. First time caller line, John is in Crystal Beach, Florida, on Coast to Coast. John?
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple quick points. There was a device found in the Alps in Switzerland about, I don't know exactly when it was found, but the device was a cone shaped hat. It was made out of gold that had three different sections, and then it worked like a slide rule. And on the cone had all these different pictures of celestial objects like the sun, the moon, and some of the planets, so that they could. And the priest kings of an ancient religion used to have a theocracy in Switzerland where they controlled the people by using these cone-shaped hats and telling them when celestial events would occur. And finally, my second comment is there was 2,000 stone anchors found along the west coast of Florida, giant stone anchors with holes in them, which indicate that the fleet of Atlantis sunk on the west coast of Florida.
All right. That's one theory. Interesting. Thank you. West of the Rockies, Gerhardt is in San Francisco on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Gerhardt?
Oh, hi, folks. Hey, I think this is fascinating. By the way, happy recent autumnal equinox to you.
Thank you.
Which brings me to the point. You mentioned, Joe, that one of the dials, or I forget what you called them, on this thing was divided into four. And it sounds like somebody had supposed that these were tied to Olympic game cycles, which I think is a kind of a fanciful stretch. And if this device had as its purpose some sort of a celestial plotter, is my neo-pagan hunch that these four points on that particular dial would be contiguous with the autumnal and spring equinoxes and the summer and winter solstice, rather than that would be
okay. All right. Well, let's hear what Joe has to say. Joe.
Well, that particular dial, the reason that they think that it was showing the locations of the games is from the inscriptions on the dial. So all of these different games are actually named on there. So that isn't too controversial. You know, you have the locations written on those four different segments. I think it's unlikely that that was what that was doing. But certainly the solstices and the equinoxes would have been very important to them. And I think from the front dial, where you've got the movements of the sun around the heavens and the signs of the zodiac and the months, they would have been very, very aware of exactly when those events were taking place. So that would have been, you know, a key piece of information that was in there, absolutely.
And they were following, to go back again, this was the Greek version of the Egyptian calendar, correct?
That's right. So, I mean, information was being, you know, especially with astronomy, was being shared and taken across between all of these different cultures. So the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, there was a real melting pot, and all different things were coming from the influences from various cultures.
And in the Egyptian calendar, as I understand it, they too broke things up by 3-month seasons. And that they would think of, in the same way that we thought of winter, spring, summer, and fall, they had different names for it, but they still had the year broken up into 4 different seasons. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about days getting shorter and longer, I mean, that's a key thing that's really obvious to people and very important to them. So that would have been a key part of all of these calendars.
You know, I'm just loving this, and I love the questions, and I love the creative postulizations that are happening on the phone calls here. So thank you so much for giving us the time to do this for a little bit longer. We'll get more from Joe Marchant coming up next. Decoding the Heavens, the story of the Antikythera mechanism and what it can tell us. What can you tell us next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Let's grab Carol in St. Pete's for a wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Before asking a question, I'd like to take a second to say I think that unknown monster is an ermine. There's a famous painting called The Girl with an Ermine, and I think if you look it up, you might think it looks just like it. It sure does to me. Anyway, the second thing I'd like to think out of the box a little about the unknown mechanism, I'm thinking, well, maybe since it was so rare and such a treasure, that maybe it was actually out of time and place and all. Maybe it was really in the Ark of the Covenant, since nobody knows where that covenant went. Maybe they preserved it, and that was something that was in it. I don't know. It's just a guess.
Okay. I mean, that would make it thousands of years older than that, then. I mean, that would put it into, I mean, if you're going back to the ancient Hebrews, that's, and I don't think there's any record at all of that type of gear work being done by anybody predating even the Greek culture, right? Do we have any gear work in, say, the sophisticated Egyptian cultures or Ethiopian cultures?
Not that we know about. I mean, again, it's really hard to rule things out, but that we don't know about any. And the other thing I'd say is that the inscriptions on the Antikythera mechanism, I mean, they're in Greek, and they are exactly of the style that you would expect from the time. So they do fit in terms of it coming from around 100 BC. So in terms of where the ideas and the principles of the technology came from, you can have discussions about that. But in terms of this particular mechanism, to me, it does seem to fit that it was a Greek device from this time, because the materials that were used fit, the inscriptions and the style of the lettering fits, the astronomical knowledge fits exactly with what we know Greek astronomers were working on at the time as well.
Tad is in Las Vegas on Coast to Coast AM. Tad?
Hi, how are you, Ian?
Good, you're talking with Joe. Go ahead.
Hi.
Oh, thanks. Hey, has anyone ever suggested that this actually might be the Lihana? Liahana?
What's the Lihana?
The Liahana was a device that was supposedly given to this guy, Nephi, by God to guide him through the wilderness. There's a really good description of what this thing is. It says that it was a round ball of curious workmanship, and it was of fine brass. Within the ball were two spindles, and one pointed the way whether we should go into the wilderness. And then it talks about the writing that was on it, and it came to pass that the voice of the Lord said unto him, look upon the ball and behold the things which are written. And it came to pass when the father beheld these things written upon the ball, he did fear and tremble exceedingly, as also my brethren and the sons of Ishmael and our wives. Then it says, and it came to pass, I beheld the pointers which were in the ball, and they did work according to the faith and diligence and heed which were given to them. And there was also written upon them a new writing, which was plain to be read, which did give us understanding concerning the ways of our Lord. And it is written and changed from time to time.
Of all the alternative theories, Ted, that's one that at least has some very interesting sort of pinion points to it, Joe.
Well, what's really fascinating also is this guy Nephi. I mean, he came from Jerusalem. It was like 2,000 years ago. He fled, supposedly came to the new world, and this guided him here. And his education background was Egyptian and Jewish.
Is this in the Book of Mormon?
It actually is, yeah.
That's what I thought. I'd heard about this before. I don't know. That's interesting. Joe?
Yeah, I think that's it is really interesting, and especially when you're talking about a brass sphere and the pointers. So, again, it doesn't sound like this is doing exactly what the Antikythera mechanism is doing, and with the Greek inscriptions, possibly not this exact device, but it certainly makes you think more carefully about these kinds of writings and perhaps that, you know, they are reflecting technology that was around at the time, absolutely.
Rick is in Baltimore, east of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Rick?
How you doing, Ian? How you doing, Joe? Actually, I just wanted to comment on the fact that the Antikythera, you know, even it was an ancient Greek creation, that the metallurgical process it took to create the gears, to create these pieces, I mean, people need to realize that they had no power tools to do this. And the exact precision of this machine is pretty remarkable given, you know, the time and the technology they were using to create it, not even, you know, to mention its ability to do what it did. And I would also like to remark on it. Did you hear anything about the latest find that was in Staffordshire, England, I believe it was?
Were you talking about the giant battlefield that they found all these artifacts in?
Yeah, it was. I think it's actually one of the largest gold hoards, and it's actually, they're saying it's redefining the technology of Dark Ages metalworking. They've actually found some pyramid-shaped pommels and sword pieces, which are clearly pyramid four-sided, and some of the inlay is done in garnet, and they're actually pretty stunned on how they were able to assemble these pieces. They're very small. Some of these pieces are very tiny, and just the craftsmanship.
Right, the craftsmanship alone is very interesting. Joe?
Yeah, to take both of those points. So you're absolutely right in terms of the Antikythera mechanism. So this was all made by hand. So this would have been bronze hammered into flat sheets about 2 millimeters thick, and then all of the gear wheels would have been cut out by hand. And you know, some of these are just a couple of centimeters across, and the largest wheel, I think, is about 13 centimeters across. It's got 223 little triangular teeth around its edge. So it really is quite a feat of engineering. And the small size as well is very impressive. This find of gold is really exciting. I understand that it's the biggest hoard of Anglo-Saxon gold that's ever been discovered. So in terms of the techniques for making it and that kind of thing, I'm sure that, you know, over the next few sort of months and years, as people are studying it, we're going to have all kinds of interesting things coming out of that. And again, it reminds us how little we know about what they were doing.
Right. And there wasn't even... was it a known battlefield in Staffordshire when this guy found it? I mean, was that a popular place where they said, this is, you know, come see the battlefield? Or I understood the guy just had a metal detector and he was trying it out in a field and they found it there without even knowing that there was so much of that material out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the details, but I think you're right. I don't think it was an established dig site. I could be wrong about that.
But it just goes to show you how often that happens, that somebody puts in a shovel to put in a garden. And, you know, it's very exciting to me. I almost every day when I go to look at news websites and sort of look for the latest, I expect that every day. I just think that the more we expand below and the more we're moving houses and housing developments and new areas, that we're going to keep coming across these amazing finds. I think they're going to come faster and faster. Adam is in Canada on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Go ahead, Adam.
My question is, who would be in charge of the maintenance, like keeping it clean and keeping it working?
That's a great question.
I mean, I don't know whether – we don't really know who owned it, so it's very hard to say that. Certainly, it would have needed some maintenance. So, yes, keeping it clean, but also probably would have needed resetting every so often. So the mechanisms for the sun and the moon were actually pretty accurate, and you could have set this thing going, and it would have stayed accurate for quite a long time. But the theories for the planets weren't quite as good. So every few years, you would have needed to probably take off the front, correct the planet pointers, put the put the front plate back on again and keep going. So whether the owner themselves would have had the knowledge to do that, or whether they would have had a technician on hand to do that, it's not really clear.
I love the idea that this device had these all of these different features to it, and yet, again, it goes back to the idea that this probably wouldn't have been something that would have been useful on a ship, because even the weather on the ship, just even having it on just keeping it on the deck, might have corroded it and required, you know, way too much maintenance. So they would have had to have, like, probably treated it like something super special in order for it to work as long and as well as it could.
Yeah, I mean, they had other navigational tools to use on ships, so they wouldn't have needed something like this, really. Yeah, absolutely. It's something that, you know, it had this wooden case, probably had sort of doors or some kind of plate that could be put on the front and the back to protect the dials, and then you would have got it out when you wanted to actually look at it.
Right. And that, intriguing, because that but even just the amount of corrosion, I mean, the fact that it survived this long, you know, so maybe it was getting a lot of maintenance. Maybe wherever it went, it traveled with somebody for some period of time who took care of it, and that's why we still have it. And the other ones might not have been maintained, and who knows? Stephen is in Glendale, California, on Coast to Coast AM. Just time for a couple of questions left for Joe Marchant. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, great, fascinating show, Ian. I was wondering, I heard mentioned earlier that Cicero may have alluded to the device in some of his writings, and I'm wondering if there's any other written documents that may have pertained to this device, or how it was used, or how it was developed?
That's right. So Cicero, he wrote about a couple of devices like this, one made by the philosopher Posidonius, who we were talking about, who lived on Rhodes, and another one he mentioned that was made by Archimedes. And the Archimedes sort of device was also mentioned by some other writers as well. None of them gave any technical details, but it's certainly more than one source talking about these things. The other thing that's really intriguing is Archimedes, he wrote a lot of different treatises about mathematics, and some of them we have today, some of them we don't. One of the ones that doesn't survive, all we have is the title, and it was called On Sphere Making. We don't have the actual document itself. And as I was saying earlier, sphere was a kind of generic term that was often used for a kind of an astronomical device. So it's really tempting to think, you know, was this a document where Archimedes laid out his invention, laid out how these things worked, how to build them? And there are still, you know, many ancient documents, I'm sure, to be discovered. So maybe we'll come across a copy of that one day and we'll find out.
Am I making a connection here that doesn't exist? What's the name of the plants that grew up around the island of Antikythera? Are those Posidonia plants? Is that what you called them in the ones that come up from the bottom of the ocean that they were? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a link or not.
Would that be linked to the?
It could be. Yes. To be honest, I hadn't really thought about that. The link, but you're right. It's a very similar name.
Well, even if it's just a coincidence, kind of a funny coincidence that the Posidonius was the man who might have had an early version of the Antikythera mechanism, and the name of the plants that was hiding them. The shipwreck.
So these are the plants that are growing on the seabed around the wreck site. It's interesting.
It's just even if it's a coincidence, it's just kind of funny. Let me get to Dan in Playa del Rey, California, on Coast to Coast AM for Joe Marchant. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. I know that the Romans had a device that measured distances. They used leagues, and it used a gear, and they would put rocks in it, and it would kick out a rock every, you know, per distance. But I guess my idea is that, you know, that there were other people using gears, but probably not as intricate as this, but there were other people using gears. And I think the suggestion is that probably also came from Archimedes. But the Romans knew exactly the distance to different places all over their empire.
Yeah, in fact, Joe, you can explain that with a little more detail on how they did that.
Yeah, so the caller is right. It was a sort of mechanical odometer, where basically you had a wheel that was turning, and it had these little sort of holders and there was a pebble. So basically every time that the wheel turned once, it would drop a pebble into a pot.
So you had the wagon wheel, and then you had this device on the floor. Yeah, a chariot wheel.
It involved a couple of gear wheels, I think. Yes, using gear wheels, but quite simple. But basically a pebble would drop every time you went a Roman mile. So then you could count the pebbles once you'd got to your destination and work out how far you'd gone. I think that's pretty much how it worked. So absolutely, yeah. Other people were using gear wheels for this kind of thing. And yes, that probably did come from Archimedes. He seems to have started a lot of this. But this is just, we have descriptions of this. None of this actually survives, but it has been written about. But this is using gear wheels in quite a simple way. I mean, it was thought to be incredibly impressive for the time. But then you compare that to, you know, layers and layers of very precise gear wheels carrying out mathematical calculations. This isn't just sort of turning once and dropping a pebble. This is actually modeling very sophisticated astronomical equations. And you start to see the gulf between what we knew about and the Antikythera mechanism. And also remember that we actually have the Antikythera mechanism. We have the physical evidence. It's not just something that we know it's been written about.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, and although, you know, that Roman odometer that they would use to mark the distance between cities on the roads, it was as functional as they needed it to be. It actually is a step back in terms of its technological sophistication from the Antikythera mechanism, which goes to show you, again, it seems like as time went forward, technology went backward. It didn't build on it. There was nothing that the Romans did to build on what the Greeks had already come up with.
Yeah, and I think that's true for a lot of fields of science, actually. The Romans, they liked what the Greeks were doing, and they took a lot of it. But it became increasingly degenerate. They were increasingly sort of harking back to older knowledge. They weren't pushing it forwards themselves.
Right. And so whatever they captured, they had, but they may not even have been able to preserve the knowledge that they had acquired.
Yeah, and I guess it's a question of what was seen as being useful as well.
Right.
They made things that were practical purposes and, incredible architectural constructions and that kind of thing, so very sophisticated in its own way. But I guess we have to assume that they didn't see those astronomical models. I mean, it was a curiosity, probably would have paid for it as a sort of a fun gadget, but it wasn't as important to them to be pushing forwards that side of things.
Steve is in Green Bay, Wisconsin on Coast to Coast. Steve?
Hi, Ian. Nice to talk with you, and Joe. I was just wondering, Joe, if you were familiar with, I believe in one of Zechariah Sitchin's books, he had said that when they took the Antikythera device and they had lined up the arrows on it, apparently it lined up to like either a 360-day cycle or it lined up to a 1260-year cycle. Something to do with that when the arrows are lined up, that it lined up to like a, you know, like a zodiac age or whatever. And the other real quick thing is I just wanted to see if you were familiar with the Forbidden Archaeology book where they found all the kinds of things in coal mines and stuff, you know, steel balls that looked like steel balls.
Are you familiar with the Forbidden Archaeology, Joe?
No, not particularly, I'm afraid. In terms of the sort of lining up the dials, there was a theory at one point. I think there was a scratch on the dial that one of the researchers looking at it thought was a kind of maker's mark that went across sort of two moving parts, and he thought that when you turn the dial to sort of line those up, so presumably this is where it had first been aligned, it gave you a particular date. I think now it's thought that perhaps that wasn't a scratch that was made by the person that made it. And so maybe you can't rely on that date quite so much. I think it could have been, I think it was 87 BC or something like that. Or it could have been, like 1260 years before or 1260 years after. So they figured 87 BC. But I think now they think that actually that was mistaken and that probably wasn't the case, but certainly around that time.
Well, we're just coming to the very end of the show, and so I unfortunately won't be able to get any more callers on. I will say that you mentioned Jacques Cousteau earlier, and he's sort of a marquee player in the story in some ways. And I thought that was interesting, too, that uh, that that Jacques Cousteau kind of intersected, not from the very earliest days, but from more along the line, as well as other people. They saw the value of this shipwreck, and they knew that there was more down there to be found. And I'm just glad that people like that continued to pick at that. And I hope that we have maybe with the History Channel or Discovery Channel or other there's a profit motive to send out more people to go on more of these expeditions and find out more of what's at the bottom of the ocean, and maybe more documentaries and more discoveries ahead. Thank you, Joe, so much for all the time you gave us. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And have a great night. And to everybody else, too, if you missed the show from the beginning, it's worth going back and catching on StreamLink. I meant to say at the very beginning of the show, I wanted to say hi to Jerry from Fond du Lac. There was some sort of computer glitch at the very beginning, and I forgot to say it. It's not the same saying at the very end, but Jerry, if you're still listening, I didn't mean to forget about you. Decoding the Heavens, thank you so much. Go find out more and take a look at the blog, too. And we'll be following the story of the Panama Monster. We'll look for an update on that soon. Hope you enjoy the week ahead. Deus te amat, and I do, too.